Osiris.
Hey, this is Godweed Evan.
We are a podcast where three friends force another friend, Evan.
Hi.
To listen to a band he doesn't want to listen to.
Ween.
It's a journey. It's wonderful. It's funny. And it's filled with great music.
Except for the Ween.
And the journey.
And the friends.
So listen to it. Or don't. That's what I wanted to do.
Only on the Osiris Podcast Network. .com.
I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now, live from Bonnaroo Festival 2019. And the road we've taken on has brought Bob from North Carolina, me down the road from Nashville, Tennessee. And here we are with, I think, probably the best person we could have a conversation about Bonnaroo with, the man who co-founded this festival in 2002, and 17 years later is still out here hanging out, Mr. Ashley Capps. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for being here yourselves.
Oh, we are honored to be here. Always honored to be here. You know, Ashley, I was reading about this morning and thinking about what was the state of the festival world in 2002. I can see it through my own personal lens. 1995, Jerry Garcia passes away. Right. So that is the end of basing your, if you were like me, you would base your summers around the Grateful Dead tour. Jerry's gone now. The Horror tour, Fish is becoming established as a major touring act. I went to Merlefest the year before Jerry passed away, and the year after, it was a completely different festival. It was flooded with hippies.
Right.
So in that context of that late 90s, early 2000s, what kind of inspired you to establish Bonnaroo, and what did you see when you looked around at the festival landscape around that time period?
Well, there are a number of different threads, and some of them, when I talk about them, sound even a little bit contradictory, because I think, you know, in the music industry as a whole in the United States, the idea of the mega rock festival was not really seen as very viable, you know, in spite of what was going on in Europe, where there were many of them. But in the States, the mega rock festival had just had a very, very checkered past. And certainly when we started planning Bonnaroo, Woodstock 99,
I just
was very
that.
Fresh oh God, in people's minds.
Mess, wasn't it?
So, you know, I would say much of the reaction that we got from the music industry was that this was a joke, at least not a very good idea. Conventional wisdom was against us.
Did you have trouble getting insurance permits? And
no, not really. I mean, we put together a really great team, and we've learned a lot over the years, and certainly that first year was quite a learning experience. But you know, there was no one really standing in our way. I think, you know, one of the things that we benefited from was not too many people believed that it was possible or that it would be very successful.
Yeah.
So that in, you know, I'll look back on it sometimes and laugh that that allowed us in some ways to get in under the radar screen, you might say, simply because no one really believed that it would happen. But, you know, at the same time, there was a very viable festival landscape in the States, as you know, bluegrass festivals, and Merlefest was always an inspiration. You know, when Doc and B Towns launched Merlefest back in the late 80s, and watching that evolve in the early 90s in particular, to me, that was an affirmation that people were hungry for festivals, and they were hungry for that kind of community music indulging experience of, you know, living together and being together and just soaking up as much music and as much of the spirit that music can bring to people coming together as they possibly could. So that was a huge affirmation of what was possible. And then there's always been New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, it seems like. And you know, that was an iconic event for as long as I can remember. And then Fish did come along, and Phish did their own festivals. And they also demonstrated that there was an audience out there, a rock audience out there that was still hungry for that type of experience and would embrace it if it was done imaginatively and done well. So that was some of the inspiration that I think enabled us to overcome that conventional wisdom that this is a really stupid idea. And then Europe. You know, the festival culture in Europe was extraordinary. And you know, there was a huge difference between Europe and the United States in terms of the touring industry, because the United States had all these outdoor amphitheaters, and Europe had festivals in every city, it seemed like, of various kinds. You know, I remember my wife's European, so we were going to Europe fairly regularly, and you know, everything from like a Brazilian festival with Caetano Veloso and Margarete Menezes and stuff in the middle of downtown Tübingen, Germany, you know, up to, you know, your Roskildes and Glastonbury's. So that culture really fascinated me. And as we were trying to build our business, we thought we didn't have the money for an amphitheater. It turns out, you know, when you start looking at the budget of Bonnaroo, you realize actually, you know, we do have a buddy for an amphitheater, but you know, at the time we thought we didn't, and the scale of launching Bonnaroo, you know, seemed like a really viable alternative in trying to build our business and compete in the industry. So there's so many threads that were running through our own business in the industry at the time that Bonnaroo was founded. And that's a few of the big ones.
Well, I'm going to tug on a few of those. So first, the name Bonnaroo. And this is relevant now because what I was reading last week, the progenitor of the name passed away.
Indeed. Mac Rabinac, Dr. John. And wow. The name Bonnaroo is frankly something I cannot take credit for. My partners in Superfly lived in New Orleans. Worked on New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, and man, we must have brainstormed thousands of names, literally thousands of names. We were going through, you know, record titles and book title, you know, we did exhaustive searches for names, and I actually suggested a number of names that people still have to rub in my face.
Well, come on, give us a few.
No,
Fire Festival
no
was
way.
More than Fire Festival.
No, come on, give us one.
No. You're not going to get that out of me. Right. But at any rate,
Brian will help us
so,
with that.
So one of the names that did pop up was Bonnaroo, which came from Dr. John's album, Destitively Bonnaroo, which he made with the Meters. And, you know, he had the Bonnaroo Horns, was the name of the horn section on the record. Really amazing record. We had him out here a few years ago to recreate that record with the Meters, which was absolutely amazing. And so that's where the name Bonnaroo came from. And I don't remember who actually suggested that name, but it stuck. It ended up being like a really fantastic name. And there's, you know, like so many good names, there's so many ways to play with it and spin off of it. So you have, you know, all sorts of variations on Roo these days out here that you know, add a lot of texture, I think, to the festival.
So I graduated high school in 1997. At the time that I was coming up, the thing was not the single site festival. It was like you know, Lollapalooza, or then Ozfest, right? It was a traveling festival that moved around. And about the same time you started Bonnaroo, you saw Lollapalooza became an on-site multi-day festival in Chicago. You see, you know, Coachella, all this stuff popping up. Like, what do you think happened that changed the touring festival into like a on-site location kind of multi-day thing?
Well, the touring festivals were always really challenging. You know, finding good sites to host a festival like that was, there weren't too many of them that could accommodate the kind of one day or 2 day load in and load out. Now, Lollapalooza, of course, was a multi-day, you know, even when it moved around. The Horde was not, it tended to be one day. But I think, you know, there were a lot of logistical challenges of, you know, moving everybody from city to city. You know, it was a very large touring entourage.
Oh, yeah.
And so the economic and logistical challenges of those touring festivals were, you know, probably one of the things that ultimately slowed it down.
So then why don't we talk about this space, right? How did this land become the home of Bonnaroo? What is the history of this land?
Well, that's an interesting history. We looked at a lot of sites. And when I say we, I met the guys in Superfly in the late 1990s. I first met Rick Farman. He was managing John Cleary from New Orleans. And John was in Bonnie Raitt's band, and his own band was opening for Bonnie Raitt. And it was actually a show in Greenville, South Carolina at the Peace Center that I met Rick Farman for the first time.
Beautiful theater.
And that must have been around 99. And you know, they were they just started their company, Superfly. They were struggling to promote concerts in New Orleans, which is a challenging market. They had established, though, a reputation for themselves by doing these late night shows during Jazz Fest and really capitalizing on especially what was the jam band scene of the time with these late night shows. And then I was an independent promoter that was really just trying to survive.
Out of Knoxville, Tennessee.
Yes, out of Knoxville, Tennessee, in an increasingly challenging landscape. Because one thing we didn't talk about is the consolidation in the music business that was happening in the 1990s, which in the United States was very focused on the amphitheater business. And right. Most of the promoters that were being pulled together under the SFX and then later Clear Channel name were, one of the requirements is that you needed real estate, as they said, you know, which meant an outdoor amphitheater. Because one of the major tenets of the business principles or strategies was to use this network of amphitheaters to go out and get artists to commit to touring with them exclusively during the course of the summer, which was potentially going to leave us out in the cold. And so I met Rick, and unlike so many conversations you have backstage at a show, Rick followed up. You know, a few days later, he gave me a call. He said, "Hey, you know, I really want to talk about this." And then I met him and his partner out in Las Vegas at a Polestar convention, and a lot of agents are saying, "You know, you guys, have a lot of similar interests and have a lot in common. You might, you know, consider working together." And so we just started talking about ideas, and most originally it didn't really evolve around a festival, but then the festival idea emerged, and our main focus was the Southeast. We were both based in the Southeast, so we were actually looking at North Carolina first and foremost.
Wait a minute.
we felt North Carolina was kind of the spot, you know, based on there was a big music community in North Carolina and a tradition of festivals, you know. There was the old Black Mountain Festival, you had Merle Fest, you have Fiddler's Grove, and you know, there was a lot of activity in the Carolinas.
I actually did a festival
before Bonnaroo. That was this was the thing that really made me feel like this was viable. I did a festival called Mountain Oasis, which was at a place called Deerfields. That's about 15 or 20 miles outside of Asheville, North Carolina. In theory, holds about 6,000 people. That's the number of tickets that we sold for this festival with, like, Leftover Salmon and Bela Fleck and the Flecktones and Robert O'Keefe and Cubanismo, and all of these artists played it. And that was in the year 2000,
yeah.
I think, maybe 2001. And we completely sold out and had to turn people. I mean, it was a mess, you know, in a lot of ways. It was a fantastic experience, I think. But, you know, we, with no real headliners, we sold 6,000 tickets. And, you know, people were standing at this entry road that was still 2 or 3 miles from the festival site, begging people not to turn their car into, you know, there's no place to go, no place to park, no tickets to be bought. And so that was another one of the signs that we were onto something. But we couldn't find a festival site in the Carolinas that we felt like made sense. It was just really challenging. And as we were beating the bushes, a friend from Nashville called up and said, hey, you know about this place in Manchester, Tennessee? Well, at the time I didn't know even where Manchester, Tennessee was, except as a promoter, I had been driving around all over the Southeast and I'd seen these billboards for Ichiku Park in Manchester, Tennessee. The only Manchester I knew was Manchester, England.
Yeah.
You know, so I remember
a seeing... very different landscape.
Yeah. Yes. And I remember seeing this, these posters for this festival called Ichiku Park. As I recall, the billboards didn't really go so far to explain what it was, but of course I knew Ichiku Park from the Small Faces song. And I was always curious about it, and indeed it was a music festival on this site that wasn't successful. It was the headliners were Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, the Monkees. No, maybe just Davy Jones. I'm not sure it was.
What
the
year would you say this is?
This is like 98 or 99, I think. I get my dates a little scrambled. The guy
woke up out of a coma and he was like, "I'm gonna give me the biggest bands. Give me the Monkees."
Yeah, it was two or three years before Bonnaroo.
Yeah,
and yeah, Iron Butterfly played.
I did wake up from a coma. The coma is in 68.
The hippest most contemporary act was Bachman Turner Overdrive.
Wow.
And you think I'm being funny, but that's the absolute truth, you know?
Oh, man.
And so the festival had not been very successful, but my friend in Nashville who had worked on the festival was like, you know, this is an amazing site in which to do a festival. And he had heard a little bit about what we were trying to do. So he knew the landowner, introduced us. We came down and we're like, yeah, this is it. And, you know, it is an extraordinary site because you've got two different exits off of the interstate on two different sides of the property. So the ability to access it from different points and being so close to a major highway, you know, you find these great sites out there, but you've got like a 25-mile two-lane road to get there. And that's not good when it comes to traffic planning. So this site and the willingness of the landowner, you know, he had been apparently very intrigued by the festival idea. And even though the last one hadn't been successful, and frankly, I don't think anybody in the community thought we were going to be successful either.
Did they want you to not be successful?
I don't think they wanted us to not be successful. I think it was a case where somebody had come in and kind of sold a bill of goods that hadn't materialized. And so there was a very deep skepticism about it.
Yeah, reasonably.
And you know, the bands that we had playing that year, you know, Widespread Panic, Trey Anastasio, you know, most people in this community had no idea who these bands were.
Yeah, so who were some of the bands?
The first year was Widespread Panic, String Cheese Incident, Phil Lesh and Friends, Trey Anastasio Band. I think those were... you know, ostensibly the headliners, but Bela Fleck and the Flecktones played, Les Claypool, you know, there's a lot, you know.
Wow. It's like musicians.
But we also had like the Del McCurry Band, for instance.
Yeah.
Oh,
I love
so, that. You know, it was very jam band centric. Although, you know, over the years, I mean, people talk about the whole jam band thing. And first of all, we didn't actually set out to do a jam band festival. We just wanted to do a festival where people would come and camp in a field in order to see the bands that they liked. So that kind of was self-selecting in a way that a large number of those bands were in fact part of that community. But the other thing is, you know, I've come to see the whole jam band thing and as more of a philosophy and a way of making music than it is a genre.
That's right.
You know? And the beautiful thing about it is that it draws from so many genres. So you've got like, you know, obviously bluegrass and rock and, you know, blues and African music and folk music of all kinds. And you know, all of these jazz, all of these different influences that would influence different jazz bands, which automatically gave you a template from which to kind of program the festival simply by exploring what those musical tangents were.
Yeah.
And then you had an audience that was curious enough to where a reasonable number of them wanted to explore those tangents. Mm-hmm. So you could go from String Cheese to Bela Fleck to the Del McCurry Band, and it made total sense. You
know? It's like when Branford Marsalis would show up on stage with the Dead, he would go back and play his gig, and then there would be a bunch of 20-year-old hippies in the audience who weren't there before. Fish would cover a Del McCurry song. All of a sudden, people start showing up at Del McCurry shows. It's a lot of jam band. The jam community, if you will, is very musically curious, and they're interested in what is derivative. Everything that's derivative of the artist that they like. They love the influences.
Exactly, and they also love the differences, from night to night to night that the band might incorporate into their set. They're almost obsessive about, the differing set lists and the different approaches to different songs. Whereas I think there's also a music audience out there that wants to see exactly the same show, with exactly the same songs, with the songs that sounding exactly the way they do on the radio or on the record. And that, that's a totally, different type of experience.
Hey, friends, you're listening to The Road to Now, which means that you like to listen and learn. Well, what if I told you there was a way that you could, when this episode wraps up, that you could just go to another place and not just get a podcast, but get books that would do it the same way? Ladies and gentlemen, one of our sponsors, Libro.fm, is an audiobook company that lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for booksellers around the country, and we've even got a Road to Now playlist there, so you can find books by our previous guests, including Jefferson Cowie, Edward Baptist, so many great authors. I listen to books all the time on Libro, and I just love it. One of the things that I do is I love listening to novels, right, to fiction. I don't spend a lot of time reading fiction, but when you get a book written by one of the great authors, a lot of times they read them themselves and have other voices. So I listen to B.J. Novick's One More Thing, which is one of my favorite pieces of fiction and short stories that I've read in forever. And I loved it so much, I got it so I could listen to B.J. Novick read it, and it was like a whole new experience. So you can go to Libro.fm and you can use our promo code RTN. And with that, you'll get 3 months of audiobook membership for the price of 1 month, which means that for just $15, you'll get 3 months, one book a piece, and you'll get yourself a big book if you want to. You can get a whole month out of something like a Grant biography or Washington biographies. So guys, if you love what we're doing and you love your local bookstore, please support us and go to Libro.fm. That's Libro.fm. Enter the promo code RTN. And join us there. We hope that you'll support them. As I said, I was a member of Libro before. We picked them up as a sponsor. I actually approached them myself and said, will you sponsor us? Because I love their model. So go check them out. You can go to Libro.fm, or you can go to our episode page. There's links on every one of those. Check them out. Thank you guys for supporting us, and enjoy this episode.
So once you guys were established here and the first year was in the books, how did you think it went? How did the surrounding community think it went?
Oh, let's all laugh for a minute.
I'm sorry.
First of all, there is no one answer to this question. But you're touching on something that I think is really a very, very important part of the Bonnaroo story, and kind of one of the most interesting parts of the Bonnaroo story, because the engagement with the community and the groundwork that we had to do in working together and getting everyone on the same page for a common goal was really rewarding and really exciting and interesting. And I'm proud of the fact that I think we, from the very beginning, we laid the groundwork for a very strong community relationship, because we never tried to pull the wool over anybody's eyes about what was going on. You know, we were very upfront and very clear about, you know, what was going to happen, what our concerns were, where we needed their help. And so there were, I think from the beginning, we established a relationship of trust with these city officials and leaders in the community that, you know, that we weren't going to bullshit them, you know, that we were straight up, we were problem solvers, and we weren't going to sweep things under the rug and hope no one noticed.
Do you think it helped that you were from Knoxville and that you're fairly local and that you know the state and the culture?
Maybe. I'm not sure. It certainly didn't hurt. I think, especially with my partners being from out of state, and actually, even though they lived in New Orleans, they're back in New York, so they were New Yorkers, and so, you know, there is sometimes an inherent distrust of outsiders, period. So it didn't, it was helpful that I was A, a little older, and B, a Tennessee boy, I think. But we all were, you know, we were all part of that, you know, of that ethos of being, you know, a really good partner and a partner that you could count on. And I think that, that was, a key foundation, because I think a contentious relationship with a community on an event like this would ultimately sink the ship. You know, it would be much too hard. And there were contentious elements in the community. There still are. You know, I mean, you can't get everybody to love everything. You know, it's just the nature of people and who they are, and you know, people's belief systems, and you know, so it can be a challenge at various points to get people on the same page. But we have, beyond the trust aspect, from the very beginning, we also tried to make a really positive difference in the community. We acknowledged the fact of, like, hey, you know, we're coming into this town, and, you know, we're taking a, you know, a community of, you know, the entire county, I think it's maybe at the time 30,000 people or something, and so we're like tripling the size of it or more, and so it's very disruptive. And we need their cooperation. And, you know, when you, it's like any other relationship, you know, you get, there's got to be give and take. And so we did focus on the give and started, you know, trying to find ways to be a real positive force in the community. I think, the very first year, I'm really proud of this. The very first year we discovered somehow that the high school marching band had uniforms that were literally falling apart. They were 30 years old. You know, football team had all new stuff. Marching band did not. And so we were able, for a relatively modest sum of money, to buy them all new marching band uniforms. And that started a process of really looking at ways of raising money for various causes. We worked with nonprofit organizations and community organizations who supply some of the help to, you know, man like the concessions in Center Roof, for instance, and it enables their organizations, you know, now to make, you know, I think they make $250,000 to $350,000 a year just for those organizations. Wow. Just helping us do that. And then we help with the general fund of the community, and then we raise money through silent auctions and other programs. So now we have a foundation, the Bonnaroo Works Fund, that targets projects that we want to support, most of which are either focused on education or specifically, but not exclusively, the arts, but also environmental issues and things that we hope have a really tangible and positive aspect or impact on the community. And and we're really proud of that. And we've it's also very tempting, especially with a festival of this size. And we've done some on a national and international scale. But really keeping most of that focused on this region, if not directly here in Coffee County, has been one of our major guiding principles, because you can literally see the impact and feel the impact instead of just being a drop in the bucket. So all of that's been part of the developing relationship with the community. But, you know, it was pretty, you know, there was some anger, there was some frustration. There were people that objected on religious grounds. There were rumors that the rumors about what was going on out here were, you know, 99.9% not true a lot of the time. But there's always that, you know, 0.1.
Yeah.
You
know? So I knew they were doing that.
Going to be human sacrifices here this year? Because that's like 80% of the reason I came.
Yeah.
That's right.
Our patron, actually speaking of the environment, one of our patrons on Patreon, Fig White, asked a question about the environmental impacts that this has had here and wondered if there were any environmental impact reports done before or if there had been since. I'll go ahead and add to this. When I pulled in here, I noticed you have a whole crew of people sorting out all of the garbage to make sure that everything goes into recycling. It's like a full-on operation out there. So I saw that much, but in terms of the impact, have you measured that at all?
To the best of my knowledge, I can't recall a bona fide environmental impact study, but we have been very conscious of the impact that we do have and doing everything that we can to make that a positive impact rather than a negative. And we've had some great partners on this. And another one of the exciting things about the festival is watching people create new businesses to address needs of the festival and create new businesses that then go elsewhere and are able to help on the same projects. And one of those, in fact, she just got married on the stage yesterday. Anna Borofsky, Clean Vibes, was with us from the very beginning. And she and her original partners, I remember her telling me the story a long, long time ago. You know, they were fish fans. And they were traveling around with fish, and they were really disappointed by all of the trash that got left in the parking lots from the travelers. And so they started cleaning it up and recycling it, and you know, trying to make a difference in that way. And so we engaged with them from the very beginning. They had worked on fish events, the fish festivals, and a lot of our original team came from those festivals and brought that expertise in. So the recycling thing was very important from the very beginning. Composting, it expanded now to where we hate to waste food. So there's a tons and tons of food that we managed to get to food banks throughout the region that you know, we hope makes a big difference there. We now have Planet Roo, which focuses on a lot of environmental sustainability projects, both from an education standpoint, but also from an example standpoint, where we've got some solar power installations out here now. And so we're working hard to really change that impact. And you know, our dream, which we're a far way from achieving, but we've taken significant steps on, would be for Bonnaroo to somehow be a laboratory for you know, what's actually possible along those lines. And it becomes interesting because, you know, Tennessee is not necessarily at the cutting edge of some of the you know, regulation challenges that you have. For instance, with solar energy, you can't in Tennessee, you can't really put power back on the grid the way you can in other states. So, you know, we also work with politicians and legislators in the state to help make changes that I think will be beneficial down the road.
That must be gratifying for you being a Tennessean.
Well, it is. It's fantastic. And it's one of the things that I don't get to talk about that much in relation to Bonnaroo, because everybody wants to talk about the lineup and, you know, the fun and all of that. But that's great. But I think for all of us that have been involved in this project, the unexpected roads that we found ourselves going down, and it really centers on this, like, you know, becoming a member of the community and trying to be a positive force in that regard. It was something that we weren't really thinking about, but is actually the most rewarding aspect of what we do.
How much of this structure remains? I mean, do you guys have sole stewardship of this land throughout the year?
Well, originally we were leasing the land, but now we own some 750 acres. So we own the course site. And the reason we bought it was so that we could start to develop the infrastructure so that it was more environmentally sustainable and less negatively impactful, and so that we could have that infrastructure to support what we were trying to do without having to, like, recreate it every year. So things like running water and power are you know, two of the somewhat invisible but very key components. And we've still got a ways to go with all of that, but, like, I guess it's been 3 or 4 years now. We now have, like, bathrooms and showers on site with running water and everything, which, you know, from a creature comfort standpoint is really important for people coming back to the festival. But it's also better from an environmental standpoint. But then again, you know, you get into these challenges because suddenly you find yourself, you know, learning far more about wastewater treatment and disposal and how to handle it than you ever dreamed you would need to ask.
Well, when you run for mayor of Knoxville, you're going to be ahead of the game.
So what happens here the other 360 days of the year? Is it just kind of maintained, or are there other events?
It's maintained as a farm in a very light way. I mean, we don't, like, you know, plant a lot of crops or anything like that, but it's, you know, we just try to take care of the land and be good stewards of the land. And we have occasionally hosted some other events. You know, there was extreme cross-country racing at one point that came out here for a year or two. We now have another festival that we're launching in October that's more of a hard rock festival with Guns N' Roses and Def Leppard and
stuff.
Yeah, it's called Exit 111. So that's been the dream all along, was to do other kinds of music festivals.
That's going
to
be great. Well, let's talk about other kinds of music festivals, because when I told our sound man, Justin Glanville, that I was going to interview you, Justin's from Knoxville.
Yes.
He said, ask him about Big Ears Festival.
Okay, what do you want to know?
Well, I hear it is completely different than anything else, and it is it's just very eclectic. Maybe talk about it for just a minute, and what inspired you to do it?
Well, I think the success of Bonnaroo and the inspiration that I felt from festival culture made me want to explore the idea of doing other festivals. And, you know, I think the first idea we all had was to do another Bonnaroo somewhere. And then we decided that was a really, really bad idea. And, you know, and that was an important decision, because the crux of that decision was recognizing the fact that what made Bonnaroo special was where it is and how it is, that it's a camping festival on a farm in Tennessee. You know, all of those unlikely things is really essential to the character of the festival and very difficult to replicate.
Thank you for having that foresight.
We were kind of forced to have it in a way, but I'm very grateful that it became obvious to us very early on. But we all were interested in exploring different festival ideas. And Big Ears is something, you know, Knoxville, Tennessee is where my company AC Entertainment is based. We got an office in Nashville now that is quickly becoming as big as the one in Knoxville, but Knoxville's still home for me. I used to have to explain to people why I live there, but now They want a real estate agent because it's become a really, really great town. It's
beautiful.
And I love it. And over the years, one of the things that has happened is my company slowly became the operators and managers of the two historic theaters downtown.
Really?
And then, the Tennessee and the Bijou.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Beautiful
and,
theaters.
And so, yeah, so we operate and manage those theaters and program them. And again, a lot of different threads came together. But, you know, I've always been interested in the European festivals that, you know, took place indoors in really small towns that had a really unique, eclectic character to them. Sometimes they're not always, but sometimes they're very avant-garde, very edgy, very experimental. And I was really interested in that music, but I wasn't really interested in creating an avant-garde music festival, but just one that had elements of that. And then we were also entrusted with programming these theaters and doing as much as we could to keep them active. And then as Knoxville started to develop this really great downtown character, I came up with the idea of just trying a small festival and named it Big Ears because it was like Bonnaroo in a way. It was about exploring the tangents of music, you know. People talk about how different it is from Bonnaroo, but I see it as being as really similar to Bonnaroo because, you know, and especially, you know, like today, you've got like Ibai, you know, these two sisters from Cuba playing. And, you know, last night the Comet is coming, you know, who are amazing, you know, kind of electronic jazz. They're indescribable, but they played Big Ears this year and it was off the hook, and it was off the hook here last night too. So you know, all those musical tangents and bring together different genres that are somehow connected to one another is kind of at the core of the Big Ears experience too, but it's more classical jazz, still got a rock element, but you know, still Wilco's been there, Spiritualize, you know, there's plenty of bands that have and could or should play Bonnaroo, but it's all indoors for the most part, everything within walking distance. There's like about 12 different venues ranging from like a 200 capacity listening room to the museum to both historic theaters and now churches. And it's really just about the love of music and the love of art and what we all try to do, which is just turn people on.
Yeah.
You know?
So one more question from our patron and outstanding avid archivist, Timothy Mossberg.
Yeah, this would be my same question.
Right, which is, he cites the June 12th performance by the Avid Brothers at Bonnaroo as like one of the he sees as a turning point in the second chapter of the career, and as a video performance that Avid Brothers fans regularly share with people who don't know the band.
I had no idea of any of this, and thank you, Tim, for what you do.
I watched it. It's good. Yeah. It's outstanding.
Yeah.
Which year?
I can't. It was 12.
Was it in a tent? Was it
no,
in
it was
a
on
small
a big stage.
Tent
it was
or
a big stage?
I don't remember.
Because I'm trying to remember. I mean, the first time Avid's played Bonnaroo was like on the tiny little
it was
the true music
and
stage
and the soundboard
like
was getting fried. We were somehow it was four of us
wow.
And we were overloading the soundboard with a cello and a upright bass and a banjo and but it was amazing. But once it got going, it was a revival. It became like a revival tent experience.
So that was like 2006.
Radiohead was
six.
It was
Radiohead.
Six.
Yep.
It was six.
Yep. And then how many times have the Avets played Bonnaroo?
Four or five?
At least, yeah.
Dane
like
said
2000.
Five last night.
Okay, well, okay. Then Dane knows.
Okay,
the big eyeliner.
Yeah. Five. I think this is five.
Okay.
14 was the last time you were here.
Okay.
I know because I don't clean out my truck, and I've still got the armband from being here in 2014 inside the door. All right.
So 14 was the last time you were here?
Yeah. We're all a lot older now. Yeah.
Wow, that surprises me.
Yeah.
Okay, so... Yeah, it felt like it was like 06 and 08 and 010 and 12 and then 14. So this would be the sixth time.
This
that's
is,
right. But
yeah,
I might be.
Yeah.
So this is from.
I used to think I can remember everything,
video,
but
I can't remember
can't do
anything.
It anymore.
But that's why you need to be surrounded by people like Dane Honeycutt
yeah.
and Tim who can tell you the things that you can't remember.
Yes, it's
11
good.
On this recording.
It's good to have.
Maybe it's wrong.
an archivist.
Yes.
Anyway, so he said, Tim asked, you know, for someone who's been here, you know, you are the founder of the festival. You've seen so many of these. What are the performances that stand out to you as kind of the great performances or the great moments that you've seen over the years of Bonnaroo?
Wow. There have been so many that I find that almost impossible to answer at this point because, I mean, it's there's been 17 years of basically 100 to 150 bands a year.
And it's like when someone asked me to name my favorite history book, I'm like,
no,
but,
can't.
But, I mean, there. I mean, that first year as a whole, you know, I remember, like, Widespread Panic with this gospel singer from Atlanta, Dottie Peebles. The experience of that whole first year and just the vibe that the fans brought to that festival. You know, I cannot overemphasize. I mean, it sounds so hippy-dippy in a way to talk about that, but the spirit that was, like, so tangible. You know, it was, you were like bathing in it, you know, in the best possible way. Is, you know, I think it gave everybody so much energy for planning the future that, you know, so that first year is just a whole was unlike any experience that I've ever had. And I thought it was unreplicable. You know, I mean, I was like, okay, this was kind of magical, but it will never happen again. And I was wrong. And the amazing thing for me is it's not only happened again, it happens every year. And it even happens in a year where I'm going in maybe, you know, for whatever reason, somewhat less enthusiastic than, you know, where I'm like, okay, I'm not that interested in most of the artists that are playing this year. And then it ends up being like the best festival experience ever. And I end up seeing bands that I'd totally blown away by that I, you know, as I get older, sometimes I've never heard of because, you know, Brian Benson and Steve and every, you know, they're booking the festival these days, you know, more than I do. I pay attention, but, you know, I'm fortunate being in my mid-60s to have a great young team that have their finger on the pulse of things that, you know, I don't anymore as much as I would like to. And so there's that. But then the next year, Neil Young and Crazy Horse Under the Full Moon. I mean, it was like, oh my God. You know, it's an overused word, but it was epic.
So did it get to a point where the Elton Johns, the Stevie Wonders, the Bruce Springsteens were coming to you guys and saying, hey, we want to be a part of this? Or was it on y'all's end continually reaching out further and further and further?
Well, initially, I think it was us reaching out further and further because, you know, the one of the early challenges was that we had been typecast as a jam band, which some bands felt like meant that their audience wasn't going to be there. And so there was an active effort on our part to continually expand the perception of what the festival was and to encourage artists to come. So and sometimes those discussions would last several years. I think the breakthrough moment for many of us, and another one of the absolutely unforgettable performances of all time, was Radiohead in 2006. You know, which even, you know, I mean, Tom York was saying, you know, for a long time that I think he was quoted somewhere as saying it was my favorite performance forever, ever, ever, and ever. You know, I thought they would release it commercially at some point, but maybe they still will. But
it was a sea, and you saying sea of people, that doesn't even capture. Like, we walked out of our tent and we're rushing to try to see them, and we were felt like miles away, and just a sea of people like I've never seen before. Yeah, something else.
And that was kind of a breakthrough moment too in the programming of the festival. But, you know, I mean, when did Paul McCartney play here? Was that 2014, 2013, 2014? And that conversation started with a meeting in London with Paul's people in like 2007. And I thought it was going to happen that year. And then circumstances were that it took 6 years to come together. And the Springsteen conversation was a long conversation. So
Springsteen and Fish in the same year.
Yes.
And together, I
and
think,
together,
at one point.
Yeah.
So,
and together.
Ashley Capps, thank you so much. This has been so much fun.
Well, thank you. Obviously, I can talk about this forever.
So could we.
I've been here for, I've never missed a day of Bonnaroo, so.
Can I end with a story about my own pride being stupid?
Please.
Sure.
Bob, I said, Bob, we got to do an episode on Bonnaroo because I live in Nashville, right? And I said, we should do a history of the festival. And Bob goes, that's a great idea. He texted me back a couple days ago. He's like, we'll get Ashley Capps, the founder of the festival, in there. And I was like, okay, sure. Okay, you just do that. You're just like, whatever. I walked into a class I'm teaching at MTSU on Monday morning. And I was like, yeah, I'm going out to Bonnaroo. I think I'm going to record an episode. I was like, my co-host is just like, we'll get the guy who founded Bonnaroo on the episode. I was like, whatever. Can you get the president too? And the next day I had to walk in and be like, hey, guys, so you know how I was making fun of Bob? He was like, we'll just get the guy who founded it on there. We're interviewing him Friday. So thank you for doing it.
Bob
so.
Knows I'm not afraid to talk.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. This episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Our social media manager is Austin Sawyer. And today's music, like pretty much always, is by the wonderful Paul DeFiglia. As always, also, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, Peggy Donica, and the newest one, Susan Sharp. If you'd like to support us and what we do, you can do that on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. We're working on some pretty cool stuff over there, so I'm excited to share that with y'all. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.